Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, who is also the co-author of Heavy Lifting. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Jim, for a good martini, we turn to not only Morning Joe, but Joe Scarborough himself. He had a very lively discussion around the table yesterday with Mika and Mark Halperin and Mike Barnicle and Willie Geist. And the topic was whether Republicans were justified in being frustrated with how they're being treated by mainstream media journalists, most of whom are liberals, at these debates so far. And it got bandied about in a number of different ways. But Scarborough eventually went on to a topic that probably made the folks at NBC a little bit nervous at times. But he had an excellent point about who has the prominent positions to be in a position to ask questions at a Republican debate. And a couple different clips here. First of all, he explains that even the most esteemed members of the media over the generations have all been lefties.
Walter Cronkite,
oh,
that we watched every day, and we loved Walter Cronkite growing up. Walter Cronkite was a liberal.
Yeah,
guess
what?
Tim Russert, a guy that I love and a guy that I respected, who is the best of the best, was a liberal. Tom Brokaw, I'm guessing, Tom, you know how much I love him and respect him. I doubt Tom's ever voted in a Republican primary before. So when you say objective, we Republicans have been forced to define objective as people who were objective Democratic voters.
And he says that Republicans are essentially squeezed out of prominent media positions. Not so for Democrats, and even Republicans have been conditioned to go along with it.
Somehow, if you're George Stephanopoulos,
it's okay.
It's okay because you're a Democrat, and that's the club. If you're Tim Russert, it's okay. All I am saying to you, and you can't do it, and nobody here can do it, name the single Republican that has hosted a Sunday show, that has been an anchor of a news network for the big three networks over the past 50 years. You cannot do it.
Jim, hard to beat that.
Yeah, he says it really well. He says it really succinctly. For a long time, I'd had the argument that MSNBC gets worse as the day goes on. That he starts out really well with Joe. Chuck Todd used to have the show after Scarborough. And then by midday, it was going down the hill. Mid-afternoon, you had Ed Schultz and Al Sharpton. By evening, you got Rachel Maddow. And now they have Chris Hayes and guys like that. But you know, who was the guy who used to run around trying to punch people?
Oh, gosh, which one? Dylan Radigan?
No, he was this angry guy, Irish.
Ed Schultz?
No, not him. The other nut violent nut job.
Oh, Olbermann?
Anyway, so the point being that, you know,
Keith Olbermann?
No, him too. Well, God, keep this rolling. This is actually really very illustrative, actually. So, last call.
I don't remember.
Last call, MSNBC. It's, you can tell it was a broadcast tight. Lawrence O'Donnell.
Oh, there. Yeah.
That guy, yes. So it's not the crazy angry Ed Schultz. It's not the crazy angry Keith Olbermann. It's the crazy angry Lawrence O'Donnell, who used to have what they called The Last Word. It was the last primetime show. Then they moved it to 8 o'clock, and MSNBC primetime began with The Last Word. But you kind of hope that there'd be a test pattern from 9 to 11, but that was not the game. But anyway, the point being, Joe Scarborough is the, you know, a lone man of truth, calling out his own network, calling out, you know, stating the obvious. The emperor has no clothes, and I don't know how much good it'll do, but I, you know, kudos to him for saying it. Nobody around that table was saying, oh, but George Stephanopoulos, you know, Clinton Foundation donor, does it right down the middle. He's a swell guy, you know. This is kind of just out there, and there's not really a good argument against it. And this is why you see people saying one idea being tossed around is to have Rush, Hannity, and Mark Levin moderating a debate. When you think of the example of, say, Kevin McCarthy, Greg, who was the interviewer who got him to make the statement that effectively ended his speaker ambitions?
Sean Hannity,
who's not thought of as a tough interviewer for Republican lawmakers. You know, he's accused of tossing softballs, but ironically, sometimes it's the softballs that actually get you in trouble. It's when you don't expect hostility and you start blurting out things you might not otherwise. So the point being, there's a lot of room to improve the debates. And kudos to Joe Scarborough for coming out and calling him as he sees him. It seems like a good segue to our bad martini, though, huh, Greg?
Yes, definitely. The Republicans had this great wave of goodwill that even extended beyond conservatism in the Republican Party. You had people like Howard Kurtz and even many members of the mainstream media saying, what in the world was CNBC doing with all these insulting questions? A lot of them had nothing to do with economics, which was supposed to be the thrust of this debate. And Reince Priebus says, we're done with NBC in this cycle. People finally fed up. They saw blatantly in front of them the bias of the mainstream media. So then the Republican campaigns decided to get together and make all sorts of demands on whoever hosted debates in the future. And they came up with many things that a lot of people consider ludicrous. The temperature has to be 67 degrees or colder. No hand-raising questions. No direct questions from candidate to candidate. On and on and on about the length of the debate. And the number. Everybody's got to get the same number of questions. You can guess which candidates demanded those sorts of things. And all of a sudden, people decided, no, this isn't going to work for us. So now Trump's negotiating on his own with the networks. Fiorina said she never wanted a part of it. I'll debate anywhere. And essentially, what seemed like a great bit of momentum for Republicans and conservatives against the media establishment has essentially imploded in less than a week.
The problem is that they have occasional legitimate points in here. Like, you know, let's turn down the thermostat so our candidates aren't sweating.
Correct.
That strikes me as a very reasonable point. Wanting to get, I think at the very least, something close to the same number of questions to each candidate seems fair. Where this runs into trouble is that Trump has already said no debates can be longer than 2 hours, which whatever you think of his perspective, he is making a pretty good point about the likely attention span of the viewer, right? I think Carson also had wanted less than 2 hours. If you have 11 people up on that stage, it makes it really tough to give everybody, you know, 10 people on a stage. If nobody spoke and there were no commercial breaks, everybody would get 12 minutes tops. Obviously, they put in a lot of commercial breaks because the networks want to make money on this. You have to have time to ask the questions. You take out the time for crosstalk. Everybody ends up with like 5, 6, 7 minutes. And most of them feel like they've been sitting there standing for 20 minutes, 30 minutes between answers. Eric Erickson actually makes a really good point today. He says the RNC actually was the right person to be doing the negotiating on behalf of the candidates. And despite all the fans of the candidates say, hey, what is the objective of the RNC? The objective of the RNC is to have a good debate that showcases the best side of their candidates, but also that lets Republicans see the differences amongst their candidates and make an informed choice. What do the candidates want, Greg? To look good, right?
Yeah.
They want the circumstances that will make them look best, and that may or may not be the ones that will give you the clearest contrast between the candidates. Somebody like Trump or Carson, look, you know, when you're ahead of the campaign, you want nothing to go wrong. So really, you want the debate to be as short as possible, and you want it to be as limited as possible. At one point, Carson wanted to have a 5-minute opening statement for each candidate. You realize, you do math, that's like 50 minutes of the debate would be the opening comments. And then, of course, you're like, okay, then we have the closing comment for 5 minutes from each candidate, and that's the night. Good night, everybody. There is room here. It is frustrating to watch the candidates kind of break up into these fighting little factional folks with unrealistic expectations. I'm waiting for somebody to say no green M&Ms.
Yes.
And look, ultimately, they're botching the leverage they had. I think you're seeing folks like Charles Krauthammer say, look, you know, just quit while you're ahead. Get the best deal you can. And ultimately, I think a lot of these problems stem from having 10 candidates on stage at once. Split it up into 7 and 7, and you're much more likely to have a better night, I would argue.
Yeah, absolutely. And it shouldn't really be that hard to find people who can ask direct, short questions that aren't insulting. I've offered us many times. I think Rich Lowry would do an excellent job, but there's a lot of people who, especially in a Republican debate, who can do that. I don't think it's rocket science. We just need to find people who know what they're doing to do it and understand where Republicans are coming from.
By the way, as far as we know, we are still on board for the Houston debate. Perhaps a new television partner will be found for that one.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. On to the crazy martini now. And there are, of course, folks in the Republican establishment who have certain people they would probably like to see win the nomination. There are, perhaps even more importantly for them, people they would not like to see win the nomination. And two of them are leading the polls right now, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, depending on the poll. They're not real nuts about Ted Cruz and probably a couple others as well. But David Brooks, who generally leans towards the establishment from the New York Times, was on the NewsHour with Judy Woodruff and Mark Shields. He was once again making his prediction that because they can't get real specific on how they would lead, that Carson and Trump are eventually going to fade. And then he offered this.
I do think it'll be Cruz and Rubio at the end of the day. I think Cruz will inherit. And Republicans are really angry. They think the country is going down the tubes. And so they have to express that somehow. They're expressing it now. And I think, but those voters will eventually wind up with Cruz, and then the mainstream voters will wind up with somebody like Rubio or Kasich, or who knows. But I just can't imagine. A major American party does not nominate Donald Trump. But I just can't believe it. I'll have to go to Canada.
Until the last 5 seconds, that was rational analysis. Now we have to award David Brooks the Baldwin Midler Award for threatening to go to Canada, or at least leave the country if a certain person wins the next election.
Happy trails to you. You know, get that passport right now. Look. I think you have the right approach there, Greg. It's time for a blanket declaration of, if this candidate I don't like wins, I'm leaving the country. Because people never do that, for better or for worse. Maybe it's a good thing. You should not give up on your country because they happen to elect somebody you don't like, right? I mean, you know, a lot of conservatives have said they didn't like Barack Obama. You probably saw a bunch of Republicans saying, if Obama wins re-election, I'm moving away. And, you know, in fact, in 2011, 2012, I used to ask conservatives, where is your go country? Apparently Belize was very popular. But my thing is that most people did not do this, thankfully. And, you know, we probably should refrain from saying, if Hillary wins, we're going to leave the country. Look, we're not raised to be quitters. We're not raised to cut and run. We're not raised to give up on our country when the electorate makes choices we don't like. We stand for what we believe in, and we fight for them, and we don't decide to just say, I'm putting my money into gold and heading off to some place in Central America. Doesn't sound right. And for you know, David Brooks, he sounds like the lefties who said, Bush has been reelected, I'm going to Canada. You know, look, go ahead, enjoy it. Enjoy the poutine. It's delicious. Winters are tough up there, but there's something nice to be said about the Canadian. I'm sure they're very hospitable. But let's not have this idea that our citizenship is entirely dependent upon the country picking leaders we like, because if that were the case, you know, like every 4 years we'd be, you know, mass immigration and emigration. and that just seemed like a necessarily complicated way of learning to live with, you know, elected officials you don't like.
Exactly. And be careful, because they got a bunch of lefties up there in Canada now. So
that's a good point. You're not gonna be, some might say David Brooks might feel more comfortable there.
Well done. On that note, Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.